The Pat Kenny Show
with Timber Living Log Cabins.
Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.
Taking a good look at all of the news, reviews, opinions and comment in the Sunday papers. And I'm delighted to be joined by my panel this morning. Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Fingal West. Paul Hosford, Deputy Political Editor with the Irish Examiner. And Pat Rabbit, former Labour Party leader. You're all very welcome to the studio on this Sunday morning. I'm going to start with you, Paul, because if we thought that the board of the Rotunda, the leadership within the Rotunda capitulating to the minister was going to draw a line under this issue about public-private maternity care and the battle with the minister here over the implementation of these public-only contracts for consultants, we were wrong. It's continuing.
Yeah, and it's continuing in a vein, I suppose, that you've seen all week where the minister is almost, not necessarily spoiling for a fight, but certainly isn't backing down. The Sunday Times, Jennifer Bray, has an interview with Jennifer Karen McNeill. She also has a piece about an internal HSE report that suggests that of 2,837 consultants who have logged their four-week work plan, only 37% say that they'll work in the evenings, only 11% will say that they'll work on Saturdays, and that the minister has laid down a four-week deadline for this to be rectified. It goes on then, there's a longer interview, excuse me, further into the paper where she says that she had told the Rotunda to end its private maternity care twice and that she had been defied.
As far back as last summer.
Yeah, and I suppose this is, the crux of her, her frustration with the Rotunda seems to have been that she had flagged this issue a number of times and that it hadn't been dealt with. Up until it became, a real issue in the last couple of weeks. I think it's, you go through the papers. Shane Coleman has a piece in the Business Post about her leadership style or her leadership approach. You've got a piece in the Sunday Independent about kind of where next for this ambitious minister. So Jennifer Karen McNeill generally on the media and coming out fairly well from this, and I think. Look, I think there's a couple of issues there in terms of how this is discussed, and I think one of them that hasn't really been broached is, look, consultant doctors are not a sympathetic class. They earn a lot of money, and when people go into hospital, their frustration is often that they don't see the consultant enough, or they see nurses more than they see consultants. So their perception of their care is often more primary. It's more about who is there often. But I do think that this whole thing risks denigrating the really good work that's done by consultant doctors in our hospitals. Incredibly capable, incredibly intelligent people who work really, really hard. And I think to kind of write them off as either greedy or lazy, it doesn't tell the full story. If you've ever been in a hospital, they are incredibly hardworking people. Nearly across the board, and I think that there's just a risk that this becomes about minister versus a protected class, and that protected class, because they earn a lot of money, and look, they absolutely do, that they don't elicit the same sympathy as they would if they were nurses or non-consultant hospital doctors.
Now, she does say within that piece, within that interview with Jennifer Bray, that she's sort of putting the responsibility back over to the clinical directors within the hospital, the people who put forward the rosters or agree the rosters. She said, I'm asking you to go back and look at these rosters again and change these rosters. So is that where she's shifting the blame? Not necessarily saying the consultants don't want to work the weekends. Is she saying the clinical directors within the hospital don't want to have that battle or just haven't got the mindset to change the traditional approach to the majority of consultants working shift work, which is during the day?
Yeah, but I suppose the other thing is that you do have to roster for when there is demand. And most people are in hospital, busiest during the day, during the week. And clinical directors generally know when they're at their busiest. Now, obviously, look, if you've ever spent any time in an Irish hospital, you will know that come Friday, 5 o'clock, you're probably not getting discharged until Monday, because it's just impossible to get a doctor to discharge, that the levels of cover just aren't there.
And is that why the public don't go into the hospitals as much on Saturday and Sunday, do you think?
I would assume it plays into it, but I think you know, I think there has to be a kind of a conversation about whether or not there's adequate numbers there, adequate cover. If clinical directors are not rostering people for evenings or weekends, is it because they don't want to work the weekends, or is it because they just don't have the bodies to work 24 hours a day?
I want to bring you in, Louise. I can't imagine a Fine Gael Minister for Health from one of the wealthiest constituencies in the entire country fighting the good fight for public health was on your bingo card for 2026.
Yeah, well, this is a kind of a bit of a manufactured, I think, in some respects, in relation to the Rotunda, which is fine. But there are consultants working in hospitals the length and breadth of the state, and that does need to be looked at. So if you want to see sort of where the Fine Gael minister is coming from and where her government priorities lie, you only have to look at the plans for the new children's hospital. And there is a very a private wing essentially being built, paid for by the taxpayer, but it is a private wing within the hospital. There's no, there was no ideological conversion, I don't think, on the part of the minister. But I think Paul makes a very interesting point there in relation to the actual number of hours that are worked. Right, we need more consultants. There's nothing more certain than that. We absolutely do. But we also need to look at the model of care that is delivered. And before I was elected, I represented nurses. They are the best value for money that you're going to get in the health service. You know, investing in advanced nurse practitioners, in clinical nurse managers, ensuring that nurses are upskilled and also able to deliver and drive the level of care. Like, we've always had a sort of a consultant-led model of care, but actually, as you see with the Domino Midwife Programme, is a really good example of that. Women will often opt for midwife-led care rather than consultant-led care. But what they want at the end of the day, and what anyone wants at the end of the day, they want continuity. They want to know that they're getting the best and the highest standard of care.
Okay, so is she right or wrong to take this route with the Rotunda, to push this?
Oh no, the contract was signed, so the contract should be enforced. There's absolutely no dispute in that. But that row is one that could be replicated in other areas. This is not all about, you know, one or two consultants working in maternity. There needs to be a root and branch examination. And where someone has signed a public contract, they need to live up to the terms of that public contract. But we also have to be honest when we have a conversation about, if a consultant is working on a Saturday, or a nurse, or a journalist, or a politician, you know, if they're rostered to work for 40 hours a week and they're working on a Saturday, that's grand. But somebody has to be covering the hours that they would normally work Monday through Friday. So, you know, you're only going to get 40 hours or whatever the hours it is you're getting out of the consultant per their contract. That's all you're getting. So if you want more work done, you're going to need more people to do it. And there's two ways of doing that. One, you can recruit more consultants, and we absolutely need to do that. But you can also look at the model of care and look where innovation is being done. And frequently you will find that's being done by therapists and nurses, where they're driving that sort of community care. So when we look at Sláinte Care, and I sat on the Sláinte Care committee, we sat for a year, we looked in depth at the health service. It is entirely possible, using that roadmap, to build a really good public health model and a public health service. But that needs commitment at all levels, not just commitment in the maternity area. That needs commitment right across the board.
Well, she does say, the minister, within this piece, with Jennifer Bray, she said the reform that we all know is needed, right, within the HSE, that she says it hangs on getting this right. It hangs on getting consultants who have signed a public-only contract to work public hospitals and to work evenings, weekends, that it needs to be a 6 out of 7 days. Do you agree with her on that? Is that a complex issue that she needs to take on? Or do you see it maybe that this is sort of a row that risks, as Paul says, sort of denigrating all the good work that consultants do within our hospitals?
I think I do agree with her. I don't think it denigrates the high quality work of consultants in Irish hospitals. But I mean, they are a significant force and recognise themselves as being a significant force. I mean, if the political spectrum from one end to the other has agreed after many years of debate that this is the way to go, well, then it seems to me that this is the way to go, and that if the public mind is settled on that, that the consultants should come into line. If you, of course, have already opted for the public-only contract, well, then you must operate the public-only contract. You know...
But look, the language we talk about battles, don't we? All the coverage today talks about a showdown, a battle, heels in, defied.
You're talking about the media now, Ciara, not public health. Media love that kind of battle. Paul was very balanced and sympathetic in presenting the consultant's point of view. But I mean, going back in Irish healthcare and indeed on the neighbouring island when Nye Bevan brought in the National Health Service in 1948, I mean, he was opposed tooth and nail, and he was asked, well, what are you going to do about it? And he said, what are you going to do about the doctors? He said, well, I will stuff their gobs with gold. And that's more or less what he did, to bring them on board, brought them on board in what was probably the most revolutionary change in democratic politics for a century. We had our own experience here at the beginning of the 50s and so on. So that, you know, I accept everything that has been said about the quality and motivation of the consultants. But they can't set themselves up as a political force against the minister, in my opinion. The minister is right in saying that. Louise is right in saying that it's difficult, for example, to move to 5/7 working, you know, if the backup staffs aren't available. And that's not simple. But, I mean, we have poured unimaginable resources in recent years into health. And I think the taxpayer and the citizen are entitled to a quality public health care system. And, you know, obstruction for narrow interests oughtn't be acceptable.
And one of the points made in this interview, Paul, is that 90% of the funding into the Rotunda Hospital comes from the department. Is that what Jennifer is saying here, what the minister is saying? The person who pays the piper ultimately gets to call the tune.
Yeah, and I think it's something that Jennifer Carr McNeill has been pretty consistent on, is that the health budget can't keep going up and up and up. It accounts for about 27.5 billion euro at this point, just around a quarter of every euro spent in Ireland. It has gone, you know, it has massively grown over the last couple of years, and it will continue to do so because of just demographic demand.
But and a lot of people, I think, felt the budget was growing, but the outcomes weren't improving. And that was proving, I think, very frustrating for people.
Yeah, and at a certain point, the public, I think, wants to feel like that budget is being managed or not necessarily shrunk, because everyone understands the imperative for it to be spent. It's just about how it's managed, and especially if there is a sense, and one of the big worries that you have with something like Sláintecare is that if you deliver a model of public health where there's always going to be a better alternative privately, then public faith in it will be damaged. And one of the big things with the NHS is that the vast majority of people in Britain up until recently had huge amount of confidence in it. And that's what sustains it.
When the outsourcing started with the NHS, that's when people started to lose confidence. And when you look, like, I was at a meeting on Monday last week in my constituency in Balbriggan, organised by the Balbriggan Community Council, and they're campaigning, as I have been for a long time, for a minor injuries unit to go into Balbriggan. It's a really sensible idea. It's a population of over 33,000 people serving a catchment area of 63,000. It would make complete sense to put a minor injuries unit there. We don't have a hospital with difficulties getting GPs. We have a health centre, which, you know, is a big enough space to expand. Unfortunately, the way that it was done, it was the HSE only rent part of what is in the health centre. So we don't, you know, the state doesn't own it, but a lot of money went into the health centre, 10 million quid went into it. So you've got to look at where the money is being spent. The budget is big, but if it's not being spent driving care, you know, state funded care, not outsourced, not anything like that. So it then we are essentially always going to be coming back to the same place of that constant question of underinvestment, and the money keeps going up but the services don't match it. You actually need to deliver the services. The HSE needs to deliver the services, not to outsource it. Like we've been told we're getting an X-ray unit, which is very welcome. That's coming to Balbriggan and absolutely fantastic, but it will be operated by a private entity. It will only operate in certain confined hours and only by a referral from your GP. So it's not a walk-in service. It's not community-based. And the people in my constituency are still going to have to go to Beaumont where there's queues, or up to Drogheda where there's also queues. When we're kind of saying something very simple, community-based care is really important, and it also takes the pressure off the hospital. So, you know, that's what Sláinte Care was about. But, you know, you have to see where the government are putting the money. They put a lot of money into agency staff, a lot of money into outsourcing. Ultimately, that doesn't benefit the public health system.
And we have an interesting text coming in here from a consultant, which I was expecting before this programme finished this morning. 087 1400 106 is the WhatsApp number. Speaking as a consultant hospital doctor, the main reason that rostering is not evenly spaced across Saturdays and Sundays is because we cannot work clinics and theatre lists without all the support staff, admin, nursing, social work, OT. All those staff are also needed for discharge planning, not just the consultant, and the staff that are working weekends are going to be missing for 2 days during the week, Monday to Friday. The minister is conveniently not addressing that. I want to go to another story that's on the front page of the Sunday Times this morning. If you're at home and you have your newspaper in front of you, maybe you've already seen it. John Mooney has been writing about how An Garda Síochána has established a new national security service to tackle threats ranging from espionage and cyber attacks to political extremism and terrorism. And John joins me on the line now. John, this is, look, it's not an entirely new intelligence agency, but rather a reorganisation and expansion of capabilities that already exist within An Garda Síochána. Can you tell me what its purpose is going to be and whether this new service will have any powers that the Gardaí do not already possess?
So there's legislation. I suppose I'll deal with one question at a time. So the guards have, I suppose, taken certain actions now because of the changing security situation right across Europe, but also within this country. I think they've been very aware of the fact that many people are conscious of problems with foreign states or hostile states operating here for malign purposes. But in, I suppose, the past year, the more this is highlighted, you've seen certain actors, I suppose, in fringe elements of the media and also on social media, dismissing this kind of thing while it's become a significant problem. So I think they were keen to come out of the shadows and state exactly what they were doing to address these issues and confront them in this new kind of policing world that they find themselves operating in. So the guards have always had a capability of dealing with counterintelligence and protecting the national security. But what they are doing now at the moment is segregating that and setting up a dedicated security service within their own organisation to deal with that. Because traditionally what you had was crime and security being traditionally mixed together. So they're segregating that. I think there's lots of different reasons for that. I think they're bringing in an additional capacity and capabilities and specialist services to deal with these problems, which are constantly evolving. And I think you'll see sort of a further separation of criminal policing as opposed to security policing in the coming years.
And there are some pretty interesting eye-catching additional initiatives here, including talk of a terrorism hotline, of de-radicalisation programmes, and indeed this purpose-built digital fortress that is going to house this new agency in a couple of years.
Well, I think there's lots going on. As you're correct, in today's newspaper, we carried an interview with the new deputy commissioner responsible for all of this, Paul Cleary, and he outlined how he was establishing a terrorism hotline and also a programme to deter people and assist people who may be vulnerable and may be becoming radicalised through contacts with people, but also online. the guards also announced this morning that the state has given them or allocated funding to build what I suppose is best described as a digital fortress. That's a building that would be protected against signals interceptions by hostile states, and also would have additional protections to protect it from cyber attacks. But there's lots more going on behind the background. In the interview, Paul Cleary outlined how they were about to acquire a new ICT system that will give them enhanced state-of-the-art capabilities for monitoring threats and also investigating them. So this is quite a significant series of packages that the guards are introducing and spearheading to deal with this new type of problem. And that comes alongside additional capacity and capabilities that have been brought about in the defence sector through the establishment of the Irish Military Intelligence Service, the leadership of whom we also interviewed some months ago, as you might remember. So there's lots going on in this area. I think the reason why Paul Cleary did that interview with the Sunday Times is there's a real concern at the highest levels of government and also our security and defence apparatus that these issues are being written off as invention or some sort of, you know, make-believe problem that we face. And that's can be a topic of debate amongst the public, because traditionally, we never recognised these problems, although we had them, and we never gave any attention to them. But these are very real problems. We're facing the same problems as every other European country, and therefore, I think the state is responding quite pointedly in this case.
Thanks to John Mooney, investigation editor with the Sunday Times, who has that story today. Pat, do you see this new service as a necessary response now to the new modern threats that are out there, or an expansion of, I suppose, state powers, guard powers that maybe requires greater scrutiny?
Well, it's obviously correct that the Gardaí should arrange their affairs to more effectively and most effectively tackle issues like cyber crime and the more modern day threats that are listed in John Mooney's piece. I mean, you would expect the Gardaí to arrange their affairs so that it is most effective. It's obvious that we're living in a different geopolitical arrangement than we have enjoyed since the Second World War, and we must cut our cloth to measure. Having said that, I think the people who are bringing these issues to the public domain oughtn't to exaggerate what the state is capable of doing. If you look at the defence budget in the last occasion, it was roughly 1.5 billion. That's roughly 0.25% of national income. If we were to increase that, say, to 2%, not to mention Trump's 5%, but it would be 8 times 1.5 billion every year, not a once off, every year. Now, that has manifest economic, budgetary, fiscal implications that are not being discussed at all. I make the point because it's not in the debate, not because I think that we shouldn't do everything that we can afford to do to protect our critical infrastructure and so on.
So should we be increasing those resources?
Yes, we should. But at what rate we should be increasing the resources is where the debate should happen. And it isn't happening. I mean, it's the security, the new security measures that are being advocated that are the subject of debate, not our economic capacity to rapidly ramp up our provision.
Okay, because he does point out in this article, Paul Cleary, who's leading up this new deputy commissioner, he talks about taking the work out of the shadows, and he talks about greater transparency so the public can see what it is within reason that the security service does. But to that point that Pat makes, Louise, is the biggest problem here that we are actually still woefully inadequately funding these departments? Do we need to look at increasing our defence spending?
Well, I think, you know, obviously this is an initiative of An Garda Síochána Síochána, so it's separate to defence. But I think the issue around defence, when I think about it, I think about the people that I know and the men and women in my own area who are members of the defence forces. They find themselves in a situation where the numbers are decreasing, because it's not an attractive place to work. So I think there's a whole range of things that, you know, from this, you know, security intervention right through to the terms and conditions of the people who are literally on the front line. So I think there's a whole conversation that needs to be had in relation to investment in people, investment in infrastructure, investment in the technology, because clearly when we have, you know, when we face those kind of technological threats, then we need to be equal and adequate to the task of understanding them and defending against them. But when I hear things like An Garda Síochána are going to, you know, establish a digital fortress, that sounds good. However, the people that I'm representing, they just want to see a guard in their local area. So there is that as well, you know, and it's not all high level stuff. The job of An Garda Síochána is very visible to be in the community. And when you talk to people, if you ask them, do they want a digital fortress? They might say yes, they might say no. If you ask them, do you want to see more guards on the streets? They will 100% always say yes.
Yeah, but we need to, I suppose, do all of these things in parallel, don't we, Paul?
Yeah, and that's the challenge, isn't it? We know the guard numbers aren't high enough, and we know that the role of policing is completely changing. You have these new threats. You have, like, we have warnings in the Sunday Independent of hybrid threats from Russia during the EU presidency. You have cyber crime. You have cyber attacks. You have Russian shadow fleets. You have radicalization. You have extremism. You have domestic issues. And then you've got your day to day bread and butter crime, antisocial behaviour, thefts, you know, road traffic. We know that An Garda Síochána isn't big enough at present. I think something like this poses a big question. Do you start a new agency from scratch? Do you take it from existing resources? How big does it need to be? How quickly can you train those guards up? How quickly can you replace them if they're coming from other units? But then you have that parallel conversation of the exchange of liberty for security, because you're talking about drone first responders. You're talking about a unit here that would pilot unmanned drones around Irish times, our Irish towns. Are Irish people happy with that? It doesn't feel like we've had that conversation yet.
No, and in fairness, I suppose the story is just really breaking today in the establishment of this new agency. And I would imagine over the coming days there will be civil liberty groups talking about that level of surveillance and the concerns they have. But I do think there's a wider conversation, Pat, about the level of defence and security spending in this country. But as expected, Pat, given the week that was in Belfast, there was a lot of coverage about what led to the riots and, I suppose, the fallout, the aftermath of the riots. And there's actually an interesting piece within the Sunday Independent in Ireland Thinks poll, which says 70% of people in Ireland, 71 to be precise, think that racism is rising in Ireland. And Dr. Ebun Joseph, the Special Rapporteur for Racism, says it's time to look at that hate speech legislation again.
Well, what happened in Belfast was clearly the work of a racist mob. And, I mean, that needs to be said, because what happened was an awful crime, but it doesn't justify what happened thereafter. And, you know, the mealy-mouthed commentary of some politicians really must be called out. Stuff about alien cultures and a porous border and the free travel area and all of this. I mean, let the two governments do what they need to do to tighten up law enforcement or whatever. But it has nothing to do with the fact that this was a racist pogrom by an organized group driven by social media, driven from the top. You would think that Musk had something else on his hands this week than weighing into the Belfast situation. Yes, there is neglect in the hard loyalist areas. There's no doubt about that. During their decades of ascendancy, the old Unionist Party ignored them. They didn't need them. Then they were replaced by the DUP, and the DUP used them as marching fodder and sometimes used them for muscle. But in terms of, yeah, you had the emergence for a brief time of the small loyalist parties that sought to represent the working class areas. But generally speaking, the politicians of Northern Ireland haven't dealt with it. And there are issues there to be dealt with. But I don't think you can, I don't think we can jump to the conclusion that racism is worsening in Ireland. There are concerns about immigration, and that opinion poll, you know, probably accurately reflects the people think that the immigration issue ought to be more openly discussed and all that kind of thing. But I think that's different from saying that there is an increase in racism. I mean, yes, we do have racism north and south of the border, but I think it's quite limited, to be honest. But there are issues surrounding immigration that have to be discussed.
Would you agree with that, Louise?
I think people do talk about immigration. I mean, we talk about it in the Oireachtas quite a lot, and people do discuss it because it's a real factor. And, you know, people want to talk about what's happening in their own area. For my part, I represent a very, very diverse community and constituency, and I speak on a very regular basis to my constituents. I'm also a member of the Balbriggan Diversity Forum, which celebrates all that is good about diversity and inclusion, and is a really positive force for good within the town of Balbriggan and the surrounding area. So I think, you know, there's a lot going on to counter some of the more negative stuff that you hear in the media. But I think, you know, Sam McBride in his piece references the loyalist paramilitaries watching on as the rioting took place. I think there has been a complete, total and utter failure on the part of political unionism in the north. And I do want to commend, and it's not just Michelle O'Neill, and it's not just because she's Sinn Féin, but she has shown incredible leadership, as have the team. And they were on straight back out into communities, talking directly to people, because that's what people need. They need their politicians to turn up, to hear their concerns, to listen to them, and to give them as much reassurance as they can.
And to be clear, I suppose there's no issue in Dublin with a lack of leadership in loyalist communities, because they simply don't exist. And yet we have still seen the same types of incidents and the same type of response and the same type of protests, riots, violence here, Paul.
Yeah, we have over the last, I suppose, number of years. I mean, look, I find with this conversation, one of the interesting things for me is always that there's a newfound concern from a lot of people about the facilities and the state of working class communities that only gets used when it's time to talk about immigration. The same people were not marching in my community when there was no community centre 25 years after it was promised. The same people were not marching in my community when there's rampant poverty, or when the educational attainment in some schools fell way below the national average, or when only 30% of kids from some of the schools go to third level. They don't care about working class communities when it's actually time to talk about working class communities. But when it's through the lens of immigration, then it's time to talk about working class communities and how harshly treated the Irish working classes have been. So I find some of that commentary very disingenuous, that somehow it's time to talk about working class communities because there are more people of colour in Ireland. It's time to talk about all of those things in concert with each other, because the working class experience in Ireland is generally the same experience that immigrants go through.
I'm not sure, Ciara, that I would agree with your equivalence between what has happened down here and what has happened in Belfast in this particular case. And I think the Sam McBride piece, he was there on the night, is interesting, because his clear conclusion is it could not have happened without being facilitated by the paramilitaries. And I think, the politicians generally in Northern Ireland have given no leadership on the issue. The cop-out, as you heard this week, is that, oh, immigration is a matter for Westminster, and they cop out of it. The question of the transfer of resources to multi-disadvantaged areas that Paul talks about is, of course, essential. But there is an upfront racist dimension to what happened in Belfast that I wouldn't like to think that it's of the same tenor as what has happened down here.
I think we also need to be conscious, and I would disagree with Pat there in relation to the leaders in the north. The Sinn Féin mayor of Belfast, she only took over in the last couple of weeks. She has shown, a young woman, has shown incredible leadership in her own community and right across Belfast, and as a consequence is in receipt of death threats for her action. And I think, you know, when you see that, you really need to back those politicians who are showing that leadership. And I think that's true of Michelle and others, because what they did was they went straight into the communities to talk to people from migrant backgrounds to give them that reassurance, which I think is really, really important.
Yeah, I mean, of course. There are individual politicians, Naomi Long's stance, for example, was exemplary and so on. But it's not we shouldn't turn it into a green-orange issue.
But we shouldn't ignore it if that's an element of it, because we do need to understand it.
Politicians are saying that immigration is not our responsibility, it's Westminster. That's a fact.
Unfortunately, I think we could have gone longer in that conversation, but I'm conscious of time here. I'm going to have to leave it there for now. Louise O'Reilly and Paul Hosford and Pat Rabbit, thanks so much for coming in to us to look at the newspapers.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Timber Living Log Cabins.